Hi, and welcome to Bomsta, an Aboriginal news magazine program that features news, current affairs, a focus on community and culture, spotlights on entertainment and great tunes, and every flavor from Aboriginal artists. I'm your host, Jennifer Ashwasage. In today's program, we'll hear about an educational website which has been created for youth to learn about Treaty 9 in Ontario, and a new resource manual is out for Aboriginal communities. The manual or toolkit will help communities negotiate deals with industry, and we'll hear how cuts to the Aboriginal Healing Foundation will affect its programs around the country. And more than a year later, a Nova Scotia Waugmatook widow continues to look for closure and RCMP accountability after the shooting death of her husband, John Simon. Plus, there's a race in northern Quebec. The Avacac dog sled race is on right now, but it's been delayed for a bit from inclement weather, so we'll hear those stories plus great tunes all coming your way right after the news. Here's your national Aboriginal news. First Nation groups on the West Coast are promising to block Enbridge's proposed pipeline. It's the export pipeline that's to carry oil sands crude to export markets in China. Coastal First Nations is a coalition of First Nation members from several communities in the area around Kitimat. Art Sterrett, the executive director of the group, told Reuters the pipeline is not a done deal. At a news conference in Vancouver on March 23rd, coalition members say they will continue to fight even if Enbridge gets government and court permission to build the pipeline. The press conference coincides with the 21st anniversary of the Exxon Valdez tanker spill off the coast of Alaska. Action to halt the project, members say, includes blocking tankers. Meanwhile, BC Premier Gordon Campbell didn't endorse the project to media, but he stressed the benefits. In Saskatchewan, the First Nations University of Canada has had its provincial funding restored. An agreement was reached earlier this week and we'll see $5.2 million of provincial funding restored to the school over the next 4 years. The deal also includes that FNUC partner up with the University of Regina, and Saskatchewan Education Minister Rob Norris is expected to request Indian Affairs invest in the partnership as well. More than a month ago, both levels of government cut funding to FNUC after reports of financial mismanagement and issues over how the school was run. The formal search for a missing 14-year-old boy on Saguing First Nation in Manitoba has ended. Reports in Wednesday's Winnipeg Free Press indicated suspicion was mounting that foul play may be involved in the disappearance of Tyler Arkinson in the community located northeast of Winnipeg. Family says Tyler didn't return home on March 27th. His disappearance happened during the community's annual Melvin Fontaine Memorial Tournament, which attracts hundreds of people from throughout the province and Ontario. Camille St. Croix, a spokesperson for the family, told Winnipeg Free Press RCMP may have a new idea in the boy's disappearance, but wouldn't say what. The paper reports the boy attended a party Saturday night and was last seen leaving from the home on foot. St. Croix said RCMP and volunteers were conducting a grid search earlier this week. Anyone with information about Tyler Arkinson is asked to call the RCMP. Nipissing University in North Bay is considering naming its library after a previous Ontario premier. A Mike Harris library doesn't sit well with surrounding Anishinaabeg Nation leaders. It's because Mike Harris was premier when land defender Dudley George was shot and killed by an OPP officer 15 years ago. Anishinaabeg Nation Grand Council Chief Patrick Madabi says the Ipperwash inquiry made it very clear that while he didn't personally pull the trigger, Mike Harris's actions as Premier of Ontario contributed to the circumstances that led to the shooting death of Anthony Dudley George on the night of September 6, 1995. Dudley George was a citizen of Kettle and Stony Point First Nation, one of the 40-member Anishinaabeg communities. Madabi says it's a very cynical attempt to whitewash the political record of a man whose legacy will forever be stained with the blood of one of the citizens, and it would be an insult to the Anishinaabeg and all First Peoples in Ontario if Mike Harris's name is attached to the library in any way. The Anishinaabe Aski Nation in Northern Ontario is rejecting a recent report which recommends First Nations be stripped of local control over post-secondary student support programs. The report was commissioned by the Macdonald Laurier Institute. It recommended that local First Nation control of the program be handled through Indian and Northern Affairs. Deputy Grand Chief Terry Wobbs says post-secondary students need increased funding, and he's adamant the program should remain with local communities. Calvin Helene co-authored the report for the Ottawa think tank. Helene is also the author of Dances with Dependency. Helene says there's documentation of surplus funds being used by bands for non-eligible expenses, students being waitlisted, widespread allegations of nepotism, and off-reserve students facing difficulties getting funds. The report proposes an Aboriginal post-secondary savings account to phase out the current system. The account would see $4,000 deposited at birth, with an additional deposit of $3,000 deposited every year completed from grades 6 through 12. The Canadian Council for Aboriginal Business will be hosting its first annual Aboriginal Business Forum this week. The forum will be hosted in Toronto and will cover business and economic topics relevant to small Aboriginal businesses, community-owned businesses, and companies that work with Aboriginal people. A State of the Economy discussion will also be held and will include speakers such as Douglas Porter, the Deputy Chief Economist with BMO Capital Markets, Warren Justin, Chief Economist with Scotiabank, and Derek Brolton with TD Financial Group. The forum is also to include a speed networking session to give Aboriginal entrepreneurs 10 minutes to pitch a business idea to corporate delegates. St. Thomas University has a new director of education. The university has recently hired Chris George, a former teacher at Dalhousie High School. The new director is responsible to attract and retain Aboriginal students. George says he's trying to build on an already established support service for Aboriginal students, and he's also working to identify Aboriginal students. He adds he would like to create a family atmosphere at the university through social events, lectures, sports, and music. Doreen Solis, a citizen of Tobik First Nation, has been hired on as an Aboriginal education consultant, and she says there's a whole new suite of programs that would be of interest to Aboriginal students. A race is on in Quebec's far north. It's the 10th annual Evacuac Dog Team Race. The week-long race kicked off March 22nd, but Kitty Gordon, spokesperson for the event, said on Thursday, due to a blizzard, the dog sled teams have fallen behind schedule.
There was a blizzard yesterday, and they unfortunately did not move. So to be on the safe side, you know, it's always better to be on the safe side and not move when there's a blizzard going on.
Gordon says that delay means the teams won't get their day-long break on Sunday and will have to continue their grueling trek to the finish line. There are 16 teams in the race, and each team is composed of 8 to 12 husky dogs, totaling 180 Inuit sled dogs. The teams will travel over 450 kilometers. Now we go to British Columbia, where members of the Carrier Sicani Tribal Council are remembering a revered and respected elder who has passed on. Elder and traditional healer Dr. Sophie Thomas died in her home, surrounded by family, on March 17th. She was said to be in her late 80s or early 90s and had 15 children with her husband who predeceased her, plus the couple had also traditionally adopted 15 other children. Sophie is remembered as an incredible teacher and has been recognized for her contribution and traditional practices and knowledge. She was also an advocate for the land and the environment. Just a few of her notable works include a film produced by Terry Jacks titled The Warmth of Love, The Four Seasons of Sophie Thomas, and her book Plants and Medicines. Sophie was the recipient of the Queen Elizabeth Jubilee Medal for her work as an advocate and educator of local Aboriginal culture. She was also to receive an honorary doctorate from the University of BC in May to recognize her work as a prominent knowledge keeper and medicine woman. A public wake and memorial service has been held. And that's your National Aboriginal News.
Thank you.
That was Mary Youngblood with Reach for the Sky from her CD, Dance with the Wind. Path of the Elders is an exciting new interactive website to teach youth in the Treaty 9 area about that treaty. Carleton Professor Elaine Keeler helped design the website and will tell us all about it.
Path of the Elders is built around Treaty 9, which was signed by the Mushkegawak Cree and the Anishinaabe Ojibwe of Northern Ontario in 1905 with the federal government of Canada. And what we hope to do through this website is to give users a better historical sense of the conditions of that existed when that treaty was signed, and to also give them a good idea of how their traditional culture operated, so that they have a richer understanding of what their elders probably had in mind when they dealt with the federal government. Now, we all know that conditions have not improved like we hope they would have for the people. So can we, through materials that we put on this website, and particularly through the games that we have developed, the educational games that we have developed, can we help the users obtain skills that could assist them in renegotiating aspects of that treaty and lead them forward in the conditions that they have to live with today. So through previous funding, we have managed to already complete two games on this website. But our initial concept was that we wanted to deal with six main elements. And these six main elements appear in a little wheel that can be seen up on the right-hand corner of each of the games that are on this site. And if you go around the rim of the wheel, you will see that one of the elements is self-government, the next is education services, then health delivery services, cultural facilities, police and fire services, and land claims. Our initial concept was that we would try to develop a game whose purpose was to bring in elements of how the people in this area dealt with this concept initially, and what happened through the treaty with that concept. Did the federal government recognize that aspect? How could that particular aspect be brought back into politics renegotiation? Because each of these six elements, it has been seen in studies that have been done recently in various First Peoples communities. If all of these six elements are present, one has a very vibrant community. And so this is what we would like to see in every First Peoples community across the country.
Elaine, how did this idea come about?
The initiative came about because a former student of mine, Stan Lutik, who's a Mushkegawak Cree from Moose Factory, had worked with me and on a previous website project, which was called native-dance.ca, which looked at dance traditions and its accompanying musical expressions of various cultures across Canada. And we had, as one of the cultures for that particular project, looked at the traditions of the Mushkegawak and Iwu Cree up around Hudson Bay and James Bay. And so he knew that we had worked with the idea of developing websites for educational needs, because that website had educational resources for grade levels from kindergarten right up to grade 12, So he knew that we had that experience. And Stan Lucic had been involved by his band by going into schools and talking to the students about their own history. What he discovered was that not even the teachers knew very much about Treaty 9 and what its ramifications had been for their culture and for their community. Consequently, Stan was hoping that there was some way that we could develop a website that would be educational but interesting, would draw in young people, and provide materials that teachers could use to explore in much more depth the treaties themselves and the ramifications for the areas where they took effect.
That was Professor Elaine Keeler from Carleton University on the Path of the Elders website. It was launched late last week, so go check it out. Go to pathoftheelders.com. Most of the time, First Nations are not on an even playing ground when dealing with resource-based industries, and some industry players don't know how to deal with Aboriginal communities. Now, there's a toolkit to help. It's a manual to help Aboriginal communities examine impact benefit agreements and negotiations. The toolkit was commissioned by the Walter and Gordon Duncan Foundation. James Stotch is with the foundation.
These are impact benefit agreements, which are sometimes called super regulatory agreements or just benefits agreements or just impacts agreements. Sometimes they're called access agreements. They go by many names, both in Canada and outside of Canada. They're essentially contracts, private contracts, between mining companies and Aboriginal communities. These play a huge role in shaping the terms on which mineral resources are extracted from Aboriginal lands in Canada. It's mainly around mining, although this toolkit could be of use for people working on oil and gas, forestry, hydro, parks, any kind of intervention on the land base that requires a contractual agreement. So this is a toolkit not designed as a blueprint, but it is a set of tools to help level the playing field so that communities can get a leg up when they're negotiating with industry.
So why has this manual been commissioned?
We had a policy forum of key stakeholders 2 years ago in Fort Good Hope, Northwest Territories. And at the time, we were looking at the broader issue of fairness and equity in benefits resulting from resource development that accrue to northern communities. And we were looking specifically at the north at the time. And we talked about a number of issues around that, but one of the key recommendations from that group was that they said there are very few agreements between communities and mining companies that are public. Most of them are private contracts that are absolutely confidential. There's very little in the public domain, either in Canada or elsewhere, that it provides some advice as to what other communities should do in terms of negotiating. How you negotiate, what you can negotiate, what have other communities done, etc. So they said it would be extremely helpful if we had somebody develop a free resource that could help any community who wishes or is considering negotiating with a mining company to get a sense of what to do. What would be the process that would be that would ensure a much better agreement, both a fairer agreement and a more sustainable one. Many agreements are signed that are really good, but they're often broken. For example, when the company changes, there may be clauses where a junior company signs and then when they're swallowed up by another company, that can null and void an existing agreement in some cases. So how are these agreements sustainable and how are they implemented, which is really important and often gets overlooked. So if you look at the Voice Bay Agreement, for example, in Labrador, the Innu and the Inuit of Labrador made sure that there was a very strong implementation clause in the agreement. And that, as a result, is one of the stronger agreements in the country.
When I was a student, I was trying to do stories on the Attawapiskat and De Beers agreements, and I could not get anything.
Well, actually, one of the people involved in negotiating that agreement was actually a resource for this toolkit, a fellow named Carpenter. Now, he was not at liberty to discuss the specifics of what they came to agreement on. But he was able to talk about the process, what worked, what was successful in the process, and what wasn't as successful. So, for example, one of the lessons, and I believe it was Mike that had brought this lesson to the table, and others had brought it too with successful agreements, saying it is really important to get the company out onto the land early on in the process, because if the company understands, if the negotiators on the company side understand what you're actually fighting for in a real way, then they can, that's much better than going to their turf in Edmonton or Vancouver or Toronto in a corporate boardroom and negotiating there. So at a minimum, make sure the negotiations take place in the community, but also the company out on the land. Make sure that there are strong leadership endorsement for the negotiating team, that there's strong unity both within the community and among communities. There are serious overlap issues where there's a lot of divide and conquer strategies that companies can use and have used. And this guide helps guide communities through how to avoid that. 90% of the success in negotiation is preparing for the negotiation. It's done well before anyone sits down to the negotiating table. It's about relationship building. It's about clarity of vision and purpose and so on. So a lot of this guidebook focuses on that.
That was James Stodge with the Walter and Gordon Duncan Foundation. And Ginger Gibson is the co-author of the IBA Toolkit. Since the guide was created to help level the playing field between First Nation communities and resource-based industries, the first question I asked her was, what has been the downfall in past negotiations between the two sides?
A number of things come to mind when you ask that question, which is, what are the downfalls? The Aboriginal communities have not, because these agreements have in the past have been confidential, as a result of them being confidential, people have had very little information from which to negotiate new agreements. As a result, they've been relying on lawyers or consultants, and sometimes lawyers and consultants have the best information that's available in the field, and sometimes they don't. So the fact of the matter was that one of the major downs was that information was simply not available to people. The other thing is that because of that lack of information, people were negotiating deals and had no benchmark against which to measure whether they had achieved an excellent agreement or not. So they're just going on guts or hunches or rumor or innuendo, hoping that they would have the best agreement. And thirdly, in the lack, in the context of this vacuum of information, having no access to information, people were often in a disadvantaged position, which meant that they couldn't build leverage, they couldn't build negotiating power, and build strong agreements that would be implemented with industry.
And speaking of industry, would you have any idea how this toolkit is being received by industry?
I'm not really sure how industry will react to this. I think industry has had for a long time the lion's share of information, and what this toolkit that I don't think any of the, I mean, there's toolkits on this topic before, but they haven't been for communities. And I think what's done differently here is that we really focus a huge amount of information on, and the beginning of the process, on actually getting your own shop in order. How do you develop your own community mandate? How do you develop a leadership team? What information do you need to get a hold of and deal with and make sense of before you ever get to the table? And in our experience, 90% of the work that needs to get done has to get done before you ever get to the table with industry. So I think industry is looking, I think industry in Canada now is really looking for relationships with communities, and I think their reaction to the toolkit may well be that they're happy to see this kind of information in the hands of communities that helps them through that internal process, because often industry comes into an area and if there isn't a strong community-based process that's agreed upon for negotiating with a company, then a company doesn't know who to negotiate with. They end up negotiating all over the place and they don't get strong and fair agreements that they can implement. I think, you know, a fair agreement that's done well in a community will be of interest to a company.
And you were saying that, you know, it was industry that had the lion's share of information and communities didn't know that much because agreements are kept confidential. How were you able to get a hold of information to be able to write the book?
the fact that we work with the negotiators we worked with, they've been the good negotiators that have with most of the major agreements over the years. So we have access to looking at agreements through those folks, but also because we've, both myself and Ciarán have been involved in negotiations across both. Ciarán O'Farkley, my co-author, has negotiated agreements for communities across Australia and reviewed many of the agreements through his research across Canada. And I've done the same. So we've both got a research track record and then also a negotiation and implementation track record ourselves.
That was Ginger Gibson, co-author of the IBA Toolkit. Now here's Plant the Seeds from Digging Roots.
If we want to be seen as an equal, if we want to be free as a people, then plant the seeds, plant the seeds, plant the seeds.
I'm amazed, planting the seeds and feeding of the people. Today my boys grow to be strong men. I teach by example, they break the cycles of oppression. The gifts to my world as I witness their actions. I see their kindness, respectfulness, and old soul wisdom. My love and I grounded, nothing can stop us. Our family is the circle pushing out with the collective. Plant the seeds. Plant the seeds, plant the seeds, plant the seeds, plant the seeds. Our ideas are oceans and reality towards us in. So if we wanna make a change, we must learn how to swim again. Understand the water is to understand the sun, and to ignite our power we must collect to the power of one. Cultivate my freedom, true responsible awareness, and by turning up the soil we seed our dreams and bear resentment. The reason why only how we plant the traditional way is to harvest our decisions to revolutionize each day. Plant the seeds, plant the seeds, plant the seeds.
Aboriginal Healing Foundation will be closing its doors because the federal government didn't renew its funding to the organization. In 1998, the federal government set aside $350 million for the organization to finance community-based healing and support services. Mike DeGagne is the executive director of the Aboriginal Healing Foundation.
It wasn't renewed. The impact will be in two places. The first and most immediate impact will be on the projects we fund. We fund 146 projects. 134 of them will be ending then next Wednesday. So it's quite quick, quite immediate. And when we talk about ending, we mean shutting down completely. As for the Healing Foundation in Ottawa, we have also have research and communications components. We'll have to spend probably the better part of a year winding down these projects and getting reports, but and finishing up our research, and that should take us till 2012, but we'll be in a slow decline as well.
Mm-hmm. And what's going to happen to all those programs that are funded through the AHF?
Well, they'll close completely, and they apart and aside from all the people they employ, the big concern, of course, is the number of people who are clients of these projects. to people who have been lined up to receive services for 10 years. A lot of the very skilled people that work in these programs, the therapists, et cetera, will find other places, but it's the clients that will lose out most importantly.
And what kind of services are being provided? I know that there was one that was recently in the news, the Montreal Women's Shelter, so it's programs and services such as those?
Exactly. The Montreal Women's Shelter is a great example. These are, because they're community-based programs, you're going to have some therapies one-on-one, like the talking therapies that most people are used to. But there's also a great deal of community outreach and to a broader group of people. So it's not unusual for one of our projects to have 140 clients, some of whom are getting direct therapies and others whom are maybe in groups and that sort of thing. So we're talking about 134 projects, but we're talking about many thousands of clients who are receiving care.
The federal budget allowed for $199 million, but it's going to be Health Canada that's going to be dispersing that. Do you think that that's going to help any clients in any way?
Well, I sure hope so. Our understanding is of that $199, about $65 million over 2 years will go to expand projects that Health Canada already has in place. So they have a regional health support worker program that's going to be expanded. Of course, the things that you worry about are how quickly can that be done. When I say next Wednesday for closure, I mean, that's a firm date. Next Wednesday, these clients will be looking for other services. So the question is, how quickly can the Regional Health Support Worker Program be expanded? And it serves people in a very different way, and so there'll have to be some thought given to how to serve the people that are currently being served. So I hope that they can get up to speed quickly, but we'll have to see what happens.
And is there any action being taken currently to advocate to renew the funding for the AHF?
Yes, there is some action by a lot of the client groups that we work with, by the political bodies. Some of the churches are involved, members of parliament, regional chiefs organizations. All people are writing in and have been writing in for the past 9 months. And they're also getting together to talk about how they might be able to, at least, at the very least, express how painful this process will be for our community, and how difficult it'll be to close these things, these projects down, and then try and open them up in a new way through Health Canada.
That was Mike DeGagne, Executive Director of the Aboriginal Healing Foundation. It's been more than a year since the fatal shooting of John Simon by an RCMP officer in his home in Wagamatuk First Nation in Nova Scotia. The community and his widow, Patsy McKay, are renewing their calls for a public inquiry. The community says the police investigation report is deeply flawed. Here's Patsy McKay, who will tell us what happened that night and tell us about the investigation.
Okay, right now, we've been asking for a public inquiry. We've been refused. The officer that shot John, he came in against direct orders. He was told that twice because there was an emergency response team en route. He disregarded that order, and when my husband was sitting on the toilet actually having a cigarette when Officer Finette entered the living room window, and John heard him coming in and kind of beat him to the bathroom and just him 3 times.
The CPC is trying to conduct an investigation for a public complaint?
Yes. The RCMP watchdog is going to start their own investigation, and the band as well is hiring their own investigator. It was a report released by the RCMP and the Halifax Regional Police. We didn't know until late into the investigation that they were actually investigating 50-50. We weren't aware of the RCMP were investigating themselves. There was a report released that was just a ridiculous bunch of baloney. You know, it's just a whitewash all the way. The very first paragraph, I was drunk that night. I'm 50 years old. I've never had a drink in my life. So right off the bat, I knew the very first line was a lie. So the rest of the report, you couldn't have much faith in the rest of the report.
So
I believe it's just designed, to slander. slander us for some reason. I mean, they made a terrible mistake. It's very obvious in how it went down, and just they won't accept responsibility for it.
And going back to that night, you had called 911, is that correct?
No.
No?
No. No, I called his mom to say that he was acting, so he was saying he wanted to kill himself. He was sick, and he was tired of being sick. He was very, very intoxicated. And I called his mom to see if she could talk him down. She had already been talking to him. I wasn't aware of that. She said she had already talked to him, and he wasn't listening to her. He had called a number of people, and she said, call 911. I said, well, I don't want to call 911 because he said he'd kill himself, you know, if I called 911. But I didn't know at the time, but his aunt was at his mother's, and she called 911. I didn't know that the call was even made until the officer, Jason Bernard, called me on my cell phone. I told him that, you know, he's very intoxicated. You just leave him alone. He'll pass out shortly. But he told me that once he had a call, he had to make contact with him. He did make contact. He talked to John quite a few times in his own language by telephone. John told him, the last conversation he had with him, he told him that he's fine. He's not going to kill himself. He wants him to go away.
And then what happened?
And then another officer came. I think Jason came up to the window or near the window, and he did see a rifle laying on the bed. John was on the computer. I believe he was playing poker stars. And because there was a weapon, he called for backup. That ended up being Officer Fournette and the staff sergeant, Archie Thompson. They arrived. Archie kind of assessed the situation. He told them to set tight that he had called CRT. One radio, he actually, Fournette radioed for permission to enter because he said that John unarmed and he's in the bathroom, and he never got permission. He was given his command already to sit tight. He asked the second time. He said, it's now or never can I go in, no weapon. And Archie Thompson responded at 10:27, how big is this guy, Jeremy? But at the same time, John was shot. He was already in the house and shooting relatively exactly the same time as the sergeant asked that question.
And so after everything, there was no public inquiry or no other investigation other than the police investigating themselves.
Exactly. The report actually came from RCMP when I finally did get it. It was very, very choose. So much was missing from it. It was just designed exclusively in favor of Officer Fernandez and total opposite for John. You know, he never missed a day's work, a very hard work man. He hadn't taken his insulin. He took by injection. He hadn't taken it in 2 or 3 days. I told him all that. He just wasn't in his right mind. And I knew that he would soon, you know, he'd go on little binges every now and then, but he never missed a day's work, you know. He was drunk every day. He was a fisherman.
Yeah, and they're out for a long time.
Yeah, he fished 2 or 3 months away and then home for a couple and then away. I'd spend summers there with him. He fished at a Pubnico, Nova Scotia. 5 or 6 hours away.
So once the investigations wrap up, what are you hoping to have to happen?
Well, what I wanted the officers to take responsibility for the error that he made, and I wanted some kind of punishment to that officer, but that is not going to happen. There's nothing that can happen now. They had time to think so perfectly with the report. When that was released, the Minister of Justice came down and he told me that they're not going to do an inquiry. I told him, you know, I think you had that already in your mind when you got here. There's nothing we could have said. He said, no, that's true. There isn't going to be an inquiry. The next day, they released a report saying that they were going to take disciplinary action against Mr. Fournette, Officer Fournette, but they had missed the deadline by 3 days. Whoops. It was administrative error, so they couldn't even proceed with that. They because the report took so long to come from the region.
How have you been able to deal with all of this?
It's unreal. Right now, it's just, you know, what doesn't kill you makes you stronger. I believe that's true. It's so shocking, and like I couldn't believe there wasn't going to be a public inquiry. I couldn't believe that Officer Fournette he's still out there. He's obviously got a problem, and he's a dangerous man. You know, I thought at least he would be some kind of, even a token, you know, disciplinary action, some kind of suspension, but nothing. It's very shocking. It's hard to handle because they don't know. We had 10 grandkids, and he was so good to them and good to us.
That was Patsy McKay on the investigation into the death of her late husband, John Simon. And Gary Richard is the lawyer for the family and community. He agrees that the report was deeply flawed, and there should be an inquiry.
What appears to have happened is that the RCMP sat on this matter as a disciplinary action until until the Halifax Regional Police finish their report. There is a one-year limitation period on the institution of disciplinary proceedings against RCMP officers under the RCMP Act. The HRP conveniently delivered their final report about 2 weeks after the end of that limitation period. The problem is, for the RCMP, in my view, there's absolutely no reason in law or policy why they had to wait until the HRP report before they instituted their own disciplinary proceedings. As I think the former chairman of the criminal of the Commission for Public Complaints said, the RCMP could have easily started a disciplinary proceeding and then simply suspended it until the outcome of the investigation. That would have preserved the limitation period and not interfered in any way with the HRP's investigation. They chose not to do that. And, of course, the Wagmatcook Band is deeply suspicious of why they did that.
Mm-hmm. And so now they're hoping for a public inquiry.
Well, yes, because we, I mean, now we have issues. I mean, the Halifax Regional Police were charged with investigating the shooting death of John Simon. But in our view, the shooting death of John Simon raises many broad questions. But there are also many questions that arise from the subsequent investigation itself, and the fact, for instance, that the RCMP actually began the investigation on their own, were joined by the Halifax Regional Police, and were actually co-investigating themselves that entire process. And we don't know, for instance, who wrote the final submissions to the superintendent who wrote the concluding report. We know that the RCMP were deeply involved in the investigation, and we assume that they were deeply involved in the presentation of the results of that investigation, but no one has disclosed to what extent. And then we have the business of the RCMP not initiating disciplinary proceedings against against the officer involved for reasons that, that simply don't pass the reasonableness test. These are all things that point to what I think are more systemic problems, and those are the kinds of broad problems that that can't be dealt with by the CPC, for instance, and can really only be dealt with by a public inquiry commissioned with broad and purposive terms of reference.
Do you think it would be systemic discrimination because it's on a First Nation?
Well, I think that, that there's a reasonable apprehension that, that that's in play here, and it has to be dealt with if First Nations, and in particular the Wagmatcook Band, are to get onto a reasonably trusting footing with the nation's police force again. But, I mean, certainly there's a clear apprehension in the community that there was, you know, that these kinds of things, from, you know, from the shooting through to the nature of the investigation through to the failure to discipline, would not have happened if these events had occurred outside of a First Nations reserve.
That was Gary Richard, a lawyer for Wagmatcook First Nation. The community is renewing its calls for a public inquiry into the shooting death of John Simon by RCMP in December 2008. Now here's Sandy Skill with Layla's Lullaby.
Come walk in here.
Right now in northern Quebec, the Ivaquec dog sled race is happening. The teams have been fighting bad weather in the 10th annual event. Kitty Gordon is the spokesperson for the event, and she spoke with Bombsida on Thursday.
The race, unfortunately, is 3 days behind. They departed in Huaktuk on the 22nd, Monday, and it's now Thursday, and they're finally arriving to the first community on their itinerary, and there's going to be two more after that before reaching the finish line in Kujwak. So there was a blizzard yesterday, and they unfortunately did not move. So to be on the safe side, you know, it's always better to be on the safe side and not move when there's a blizzard going on. And so that's what they did yesterday. There was 0 kilometers covered, and today they're finally making their way to kind of the first community on their itinerary.
Okay, and this is an annual event, I understand, and what number is it?
This is the 10th anniversary of Ivaquec, and this is the 9th edition, so it's making it the 9th race, and become more and more popular year after year, and to the world, and to the public, yeah, and this year we have 16 teams.
And where are they all from?
They vary from 7 communities. And there's a few from each community. I'll name them to you. In total, they all come from Kujuak, Tesiuyak, Aupaluk, Huaktuk, Kanyasuyak, Puverituk, and Inukjuak.
Are they regularly part of the race?
Some are regular, and some are new. I could tell you right away that there's a new racer, Alan Gordon. He's from Kujwak. And last year, there was the first time in Ivaquec's history that a girl joined the race, and this is her second year. She's from Inukjuak, and her name is Lizzie Ann Kasudluak. So that mixed things up a little bit. So, yeah, this is her second year participating in the race.
Wow, that's really interesting. How did she place last year?
No, unfortunately, I can't get it right now. But as of right now, they're in third place.
Wow, that's pretty good. So do your participants, I guess they would put a lot of work into their practice runs?
Yes, they have to prepare in advance, at least, you know, a month or so in advance to start doing practice runs, and then we have to give them pills so that, you know, they don't get worms on the way during the race. So there's some medication that have to be given to the dogs, and you have to kind of change your diet to dog food. So there's a bit of a transition for the dogs, and I believe that they're usually fed country food, and this time around they're fed, you know, store-bought dog food.
So country food means?
Meaning like frozen fish.
Okay.
And like seal blubber, whale blubber, that sort of stuff.
Oh, okay, because they have to maintain their fat levels because of the cold.
Yes, absolutely.
So it's a 3-day trek?
Oh, well, depending on, it's about a week or so, but like I mentioned before, we're already 3 days behind, and so we're going to try to make it from the two next communities in 1 day, from Aupaluk to Tasiuyak in 1 day. So we're going to have to have probably some catching up to do, and usually the racers take a break on Sunday after they had left, let's say they left on Monday, and on Sunday usually they take a break, but that break has been taken off because of the setbacks.
That was Kitty Gordon, spokesperson for the 10th annual Ivaquec Dog Sled Race in northern Quebec. You've been listening to Bombsida with Jennifer Ashwasagay. Bombsida is an Aboriginal news magazine program which includes current affairs, arts and entertainment, and a cross-genre of music from Aboriginal artists. Bombsida means walking together in the Anishinaabe language. Music for the program is courtesy of Burnt Project One. If you have comments or story ideas, visit my website at bombsida.com. That's B-A-M-O-S-E-D-A. And thanks for listening to Bombsida.